brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm Hanson Su, curator for the Museum's Center for Software History. What you're about to hear is an audio version of my 2018 Core Magazine article. After introducing the iPhone in early 2007, Steve Jobs announced that third-party developers could write web applications for it, but not native apps. Unlike native apps, which are written using the same libraries that Apple uses to create the apps built into the iPhone, web apps use browser technologies, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, that incur a performance penalty and do not produce the same look and feel. By October of 2007, however, Jobs had changed his tune. A full iPhone Software Development Kit, or SDK, that let programmers outside of Apple write native iPhone applications would be publicly available the next March. Moreover, developers would sell their iPhone apps through an Apple-curated App Store to launch July 2008. This official store would be the only way to get third-party apps on the phone without jailbreaking it. This touched off another Silicon Valley gold rush as entrepreneurs and investors raced to create iPhone apps and cash in. The billion-dollar acquisition of Instagram by Facebook in 2012 epitomized this new tech boom. Today, the iOS platform, despite competition from Google's Android, remains the premier platform for mobile app development. Apps are often developed first for iOS, or at least concurrently with Android, and developers are more likely to make money with iOS apps. The large library of iPhone apps likewise locks in users. They are unlikely to leave Apple's integrated ecosystem if they have to repurchase their apps on Android. All of this secures Apple's user base. Arguably, the App Store has been key to the sustained business success of the iPhone and its sister device, the iPad. However, none of this may have been possible if Apple had not built the iPhone using technologies that made it easy to write software for it. The App Store opened just a year after the iPhone first shipped, and with many apps available on day one. What made this possible? The answer is that the iPhone SDK, dubbed Cocoa Touch by Apple Marketing, is very similar in design to Cocoa, the development environment for Apple's desktop operating system, Mac OS X. Developers for both platforms used the Objective-C language, similar design patterns, and wrote code that could be easily shared between a Mac and an iOS app. Mac developers, familiar with Cocoa, needed little to pick up iPhone development, and were among the first to produce iPhone apps. Cocoa itself was designed to make it easy for a single developer to quickly write fully featured applications, so basing the iPhone SDK on Cocoa was intended to carry over these benefits. Nevertheless, selecting Cocoa for the iPhone was not a foregone conclusion. This has been uncovered by research conducted as part of the Computer History Museum's iPhone 360 project, involving a series of public panel events with key participants in the iPhone's development, as well as oral histories of iPhone engineers and managers. These sources corroborate some of the findings of Bryant Merchant in his account of the iPhone's creation, The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. As revealed by these new sources, several technologies competed to become the iPhone's, quote, software stack, each with very different implications for app development. A software stack is the vertically layered set of libraries and interfaces that provides a particular software platform with its unique set of capabilities, constraints, and performance characteristics. Each layer in the stack provides a simplified interface to the functions of the layer below it, making them easier for programmers to use. These layers are packaged as frameworks, or shared code libraries, whose capabilities are provided to programmers through application programmer interfaces, or APIs. Initially in 2005, contention over which technology stack should power the iPhone reflected competition within Apple between two teams led by strong-willed managers, Tony Fadell's hardware division and Scott Forstall's software division. Tony Fadell joined Apple in 2001 to design the iPod, and by 2004 had become the vice president of the iPod engineering group. In 2004, mobile phones were acquiring the ability to play music, MP3s, which was a potential threat to Apple's iPod business. To address this threat, Fadell's iPod division created a prototype that was an iPod with phone dialing capability. Dialing was done using the iPod's famous click wheel, evoking a rotary phone. This prototype was initially encouraged, but ultimately rejected by Steve Jobs. Nevertheless, Fadell's team had experience with consumer devices and knew how to make software to run in the limited hardware of a portable device without draining the battery. They proposed using a stripped-down version of Linux for the iPhone's software stack. It wouldn't matter to the end user what operating system the iPhone ran, Fadell's group argued, because they considered the iPhone as a, quote, embedded device, like the iPod, that users would simply take as is, without the ability to change the software. According to Andy Grignon, an engineer working in Fadell's group,
"We have this big fight between Fadell's org and Scott Forstall's org. We have this big fight on what's the thing that we should make, right? What's the software architecture? We have this idea to build the phone on top of Linux and using WebKit. And we had prototyped it. It was well within like this realm of feasibility. And the argument was always, we can't ship, we Apple can't ship a device based on Linux. And we're like, why? I mean, does anybody know what the operating system of the airport is? Which is VxWorks, but anybody know? Nope. Why should the phone be any different? Do they know what the operating system of the iPod was? Nope. So the phone, in our eyes, was just another version of consumer electronics.
Scott Forstall, however, had other plans. Forstall was the head of platform experience, the team responsible for macOS 10's user interface, applications, and software environment. Forstall and his team saw the iPhone not as an embedded device, but as a computer platform, which could run many different kinds of software and not just those built by Apple. They were convinced that iPhone's software stack should run a variant of macOS 10 technology, that is, Cocoa. Neetan Ganatra, an Apple engineer who became the manager of the iPhone applications team, explained that using Cocoa technologies for the iPhone would allow him to poach employees from other groups within Apple, and thereby quickly write the iPhone's core apps. Says Ganatra,
"But we really wanted to make sure that developers who came in and started implementing phone apps could feel as comfortable as possible right away. And we knew that internally, at least, we had a lot of engineers who understood AppKit and Foundation. We wanted to keep as much of that as familiar as possible so that there wasn't just this huge learning curve for anybody coming in where they wouldn't know how to do anything. We really wanted to make it so that they had an understanding of the foundational components that had already been there on OS X. We wanted to make sure that they leveraged that knowledge and only had to learn, you know, the new parts that were unique to development of a phone app."
Forstall's software team eventually won, with iPhone running a variant of macOS X. Instead of using Linux, the iPhone's OS was based on the same mock kernel and BSD Unix used in OS X. iPhone also used many of OS X's lower-level libraries, such as its graphics and animation frameworks. But another decision loomed. Should iPhone's built-in apps be developed using native OS X technologies, such as Cocoa, or should they use web technologies? macOS X had a feature called Dashboard that held widgets showing information like stocks and weather that were quickly launched on a user's desktop. Widgets were, in essence, miniature web pages and were written using HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, the languages of the web. On OS X, this was done using WebKit, the framework behind Apple's Safari web browser. WebKit provided web browsing functionality across the macOS X system, not just in a standalone browser like Safari. Dashboard widgets proved that it was possible to make small app-like programs that could be made to look native, using only web technologies. Since web browsing with Safari was a crucial feature of the iPhone, it was straightforward for the iPhone web team to port the weather and stocks widgets to the phone. Indeed, the designs of these apps on the original iPhone were the same as their dashboard widget predecessors. The advantage of WebKit was that many more third-party developers knew JavaScript than Apple's Objective-C language. Objective-C was the language used by Cocoa, and was known mostly only to a small community of Mac developers. The web, however, was an open platform, with millions of developers trained in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. However, web technology had a key disadvantage. Web apps tended to be slower and use more memory. Memory on the iPhone was extremely scarce, only 128 megabytes. And if an app used too much memory, the OS would terminate it. This is still how iOS works today. One of the advantages of Fidel's team's iPod stack proposal was that it would use much less memory than a full Mac OS X stack. Using web technologies might exacerbate this performance problem by requiring more memory than a native OS X Cocoa stack. Richard Williamson, manager of the iPhone web team, has a more nuanced take on the drawbacks of web apps. According to Williamson, his team knew how to write web apps that were lean and fast, but the complexity of web technologies does not encourage this, leading most web apps to be bloated and slow. Says Williamson,
"My personal struggles with the web is that web standards are so, they've evolved so crazily, not with a single architecture in mind, but just over time, that it's possible to make really great things with web technologies. It's also very easy to make crappy things. And there isn't really a clear path that guides you in the right direction. Nowadays, there's a lots of JavaScript frameworks that try to do this, that give you the best of the web and hide the worst. But still, it's very easy to make something that's fragile. If we couldn't be productive with these technologies, how, and we know the engine intimately, then how could external developers be productive? Now, having said that, I still have a lot of hope for web technologies, and I think with a lot of these new JavaScript frameworks, not even new, but JavaScript frameworks, it's possible to write good web applications. But you have to have really good developers that understand the technologies really well.
On the other hand, according to Williamson, Apple's native Cocoa environment steers developers in the right direction, making it easier for them to apply best practices. In addition, Apple already had a sophisticated developer toolchain for its native Cocoa developers, which could be easily leveraged to build apps for the iPhone if they used similar technologies. Apple did not have special tools for building web applications, says Williamson.
As far as providing really good tools to generate web applications for the iPhone, we didn't have all those great tools. It wasn't like you could use Xcode and do something great. A great developer story has all of that. It has the frameworks, it has the IDE. So it was a pretty weak developer story. A lot of what we do at Apple is create frameworks that make it easy to do the right thing and hard to do the wrong thing. So ultimately, that's what the decision came down to. We had a small team of people, and we had to do an awful lot of work very quickly. And using a traditional kind of Objective-C framework, similar to AppKit, could get us there much more quickly. It wasn't about performance. It was about developer productivity and how rapidly you could develop an application.
Eventually, a compromise was reached. Apps ported from Dashboard by the web team, like Stocks and Weather, would continue to use WebKit and would be owned by the web team under Williamson, while most of the rest of the apps on the iPhone, to be written by Neaton Ganatra's apps group, would use a native solution. Yet even the native solution had multiple possibilities. One option investigated by Ganatra's engineers, led by Scott Hertz, was to bring OS X's Cocoa framework straight over to the iPhone, stripping out what wasn't necessary. The central component of Cocoa was the AppKit, the layer in the OS X stack that apps sit directly on top of. AppKit has a long history, going back to the late 1980s at Next, Steve Jobs' second computer company. Apple acquired Next in 1997 for its operating system, NextStep, which became the basis for Mac OS X. The AppKit thus has a lot of legacy code to support old hardware that is no longer necessary, bloating the code base. Moreover, the AppKit is designed for mouse input, while the iPhone was to be completely controlled with multi-touch, using new finger gestures being designed by the Human Interface Group under Greg Christie. The leaders of the Cocoa team, Ali Ozer and Kristen Forster, made the case that the iPhone group should not use the AppKit because the AppKit was already weighed down with legacy and would require significant effort to retrofit to support multi-touch, increasing complexity and thus the potential for bugs. This work would add to the AppKit team's workload on top of its work building new features for OS X on the desktop. Without the support of the AppKit team, this proposal was dead. Ganatra explains.
The first option was taking existing macOS, an existing macOS framework that's used for drawing widgets and controls and things today called AppKit, and porting that over to make that the basis for all widgets on the phone itself. You know, if anybody was going to make the argument that we should use AppKit for future phone development, it would have been the manager of the AppKit team. But they were well aware of all the ways that the event system and that menus and that mice and that, you know, all these things that were very essential to how desktop computers work, they were so embedded into how AppKit handled events and did so much of what it does. They themselves, Kristen and Ali, were making the argument that it's just not well suited for something like touch or for multiple layers on the screen or things like that. So the fact that they were arguing against using AppKit, to me, was, you know, was the strongest argument that, okay, they're super smart people, you know, and they understand their technology better than anyone. And so why would we try to use AppKit when the experts are saying we really shouldn't?
Neaton Ganatra's engineers ultimately decided that it would be better to start from a clean slate and write a new framework from scratch, which they called UIKit. As Ganatra describes it, although UIKit was designed according to the same principles as AppKit, it was tailored for multi-touch input, and in the beginning only contained what was necessary to write iPhone's initial apps, including a phone calling app with a built-in address book, a music player, and an email client. All of these apps contained lists of text that had to be scrolled at a smooth 60 frames per second, and when tapped by a finger, could drill down to reveal another screen with more detail. This made it a natural component to be shared in the UIKit library by all apps, rather than each having their own implementation. Ganatra's team settled on a rule of three. As soon as three or more applications needed to use the same component, the code should be removed from the individual apps and go into UIKit instead. From the perspective of Ganatra's UIKit engineers, starting fresh meant that UIKit could be lean and contain only what was absolutely necessary, with none of the baggage of the AppKit. Moreover, it offered the opportunity to improve upon the AppKit's design in a way better suited to the needs of a more modern and mobile platform. Lastly, the team would not need to worry about supporting compatibility with existing Mac applications, which allowed them to explore more radical ideas and move quickly. Nevertheless, because the UIKit shared its main design principles with the AppKit, it could also share in its benefits. Macintosh developers using Coco had for years argued that Coco's thoughtful, elegant, consistent, and object-oriented design made writing programs using it an order of magnitude more productive than with other frameworks. As a result, with UIKit, the team was able to implement the human interface team's designs for the iPhone's built-in apps and make them butter smooth and fast. Fast enough that, according to Ganatra, it was decided that Williamson's web team should rewrite its own stocks, weather, and clock widgets using the native UIKit instead of WebKit so that they would launch faster. Thus, by the time the original iPhone shipped in June 2007, only Safari, of the iPhone's built-in apps, was built primarily using WebKit, although all iOS apps, even those using UIKit, had a bit of WebKit in them, as WebKit was actually used for all text input in the original iPhone. With UIKit, the iPhone had its own native software stack, ready to be opened up to developers. When third-party developers at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, or WWDC, got to see the iPhone before its public release, they complained that web apps would likely be inferior to Apple's native apps. They were concerned that web apps might run slower or might look different, lacking the polished UI that users expected from Apple's apps. Web apps would also not have access to the iPhone's sensors, such as its accelerometer, that made possible some of the iPhone's most prominent features. Ganatra notes that if WebKit wasn't good enough for Apple's own apps, why should third-party developers be satisfied with it? Says Ganatra,
there were definitely a lot of requests that came between January and even when we shipped, people coming coming and saying, hey, web stuff, you know, web technologies aren't, they're not going to work as well as what you demoed. So why is that the answer for third parties? More and more at Apple, there was an there's always been this understanding that if you've created two technologies, one for your own use and one for third parties or for somebody else to use, then that must have been for a reason. It must be that, you know, either the things that you're doing are so different from what you expect third parties to do that you need to have some brand new, you know, some technology that's different, or you think that what, you know, a third party will be doing or could do is not as important or as compelling or interesting as what you may be doing on your own. So that's why you have two. In either case, it's not a great answer. You know, it's just not, you're not in a great position if you have kind of a different solution for yourself than you have for your third-party partners.
Developers did not want access only to a second-class solution, with Apple giving its own engineers preferential treatment. Thus, when Scott Forstall and other executives finally convinced Steve Jobs to allow native third-party apps for the iPhone, the infrastructure of UIKit was already in place. The SDK's interfaces needed to be cleaned up for public consumption, but the heavy lifting was done. Had the decision been made to use the hardware team's iPod stack instead, opening up the iPhone to third-party apps might have taken much longer. Perhaps Mac developers would not have been able to learn iPhone development so quickly, or produce as high-quality apps in as little time. The App Store might not have taken off as it did with as many apps. Competing platforms, not just Android, but also Palm's WebOS and Microsoft's Windows Phone, might have had an opportunity to catch up with the iPhone. Apple's decision to base iPhone software on OS X stacked the deck such that, except for Google's Android platform, competitors have never caught up. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of From the Archives. This episode was produced by me, Hanson Su. Thanks to John Plute for composing our music, and thanks to Chris Garcia for editing. You can learn more about the Center for Software History and hear more from our archives at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.